Hello everyone and welcome to today's webinar, Sadie's Story, Helping Women Affected by Domestic and Family Violence Navigate a Fragmented System. My name is Adam Dean. I'm a Senior Research Officer with the CFCA Information Exchange here at the Australian Institute of Family Studies. I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the lands on which we are meeting. In Melbourne, the traditional custodians are the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I pay my respects to their elders, past and present, and to the elders from other communities who may be participating today. In today's webinar, we are focusing on a case study to help illustrate how women affected by domestic and family violence might experience our service systems. We'll reflect on this case study to look at how policies and practices can be improved to help ensure women receive the support they need. We wanted to reiterate that although this case study is based on real accounts and experiences, the name Sadie is not the real name of the person interviewed in the research. For those attendees who are tuning in from the Northern Territory, we have recently been notified that this name was shared by someone with very similar experiences who tragically died. We understand that legal proceedings in relation to criminal charges over her death are currently underway. We want to apologise for any distress that listeners familiar with this case in the Northern Territory may experience. We also want to provide a warning to all our attendees that some of the content discussed today might be confronting. If at any time you are feeling affected by the mention of the name Sadie or any details of the case study, please feel free to leave the webinar. This is understandable. Self-care and looking out for others around you should be a priority. Finally, before I introduce our presenters and go through some quick housekeeping, I'd like to acknowledge this webinar is presented in collaboration with ANROS and in consultation with Stephen Locke, who is a practice leader at the Department of Child Safety, Youth and Women, Queensland. As you may be aware, the ANROS conference has been postponed due to COVID-19. However, please keep an eye out on the ANROS website for updates. ANROS also has a webinar program underway featuring the newly published research about addressing violence against women and their children. Check out the ANROS website for more details. Emma Rogers, Jackie Ruck, and Steve Locke will be presenting further on their work at the Safe and Together Queensland Summit. This event has also been postponed and a new date will be announced in due course. In the meantime, though, please email Steve to register your interest. Details have been provided in the chat box. Now to our presenters. Today, we are joined by three eminent experts in the field, Dr. Ray Kaspiev, Emma Rogers, and Jackie Ruck. Ray is a Senior Research Fellow at the Australian Institute of Family Studies. Ray is a leading socio-legal researcher with particular expertise in family law and family violence, who currently manages the Family Law and Family Violence Research Program at AFES. Ray was the lead researcher for the ANROS project that has informed much of this webinar today. Ray will be presenting key findings of this research, including key themes from Sadie's story for today's presentation. Following Ray, Emma and Jackie will present together on the implications for practice. Emma is a domestic and family violence senior practitioner based at the Department of Child Safety, Youth and Women in Queensland, where for the past 3 years she has developed and worked in the Walking with Dads program. Emma has 25 years of experience as a social worker here in Australia and also in the UK in the areas of domestic and family violence, including women's refuges, also working in mental health, youth homelessness, asylum seeker support, and in child protection. Emma is also a certified Safe and Together trainer. Joining Emma will be Jackie. Jackie is a proud Aboriginal Wundindji woman from far north Queensland, Yarrabah region, and domestic and family violence senior project officer for the Department of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Partnerships in Queensland. Jackie's own experience of domestic and family violence led her to becoming a certified Safe and Together trainer and a facilitator and cultural advisor for the Walking with Dads program that works and walks with fathers who have perpetrated violence in their families. Now, just quickly on some housekeeping, we encourage you to submit any questions you might have by the chat box, which you can find on the GoToWebinar side panel. We'll also try to get to as many questions as possible during the Q&A session at the end of today's presentation. Any questions that we can't get to will be answered in the online forum. Please let us know if you don't want your question or your name published on the online forum following the presentation. Please also note a PDF version of the presentation slides is now available in the handout section of GoToWebinar, and a copy of the PowerPoint presentation along with a recording of this webinar will be available in the coming weeks. Subscribe to CFCA News to be notified once the webinar slides and recording are available. And now finally, I'll hand over to Ray, who will be our first presenter. Please give Ray a very warm virtual welcome. Ray.
Thanks, Adam. Now we're going to talk about Sadie's story and use it to help us think about how we can assist women affected by family and domestic violence as they navigate a fragmented service system. Before I start talking about the research that Sadie's story comes from, I just want to let you know that the views expressed in this paper are my views. They're not the views of the Australian Institute of Family Studies or the Australian government or the body that funded the research, the Australian National Research Organisation for Women's Safety. So when we think about Sadie's story, the case study that I hope you've all read, available on the website, we understand that Sadie's story illustrates a number of significant themes that affect many women who experience domestic and family violence. It shows us about the ongoing impacts of domestic and family violence on women and their children, including on their parenting capacity and their relationships with their children. It demonstrates to us how systems abuse is perpetrated by ex-partners and how these women face a fragmented response by the service system that in turn allows system abuse to go on. Sadie's story helps us think about how policies and practices can be improved. So Sadie's story comes from the Domestic and Family Violence and Parenting Research Project. This project focused on three main research questions. We wanted to look at how interparental conflict and domestic and family violence affect mother-child and father-child relationships. There was a gap in the research about this. We also wanted to know how mothers who had experienced domestic and family violence perceived this had affected their relationship with their children. And we wanted to understand to what extent and to what effect these mothers had had contact with services and agencies in the child protection, family law, and domestic and family violence systems. The research was based on several different elements. We did a literature review. We also looked at some longitudinal data sets. So La Trobe University, Professor Jan Nicholson from Judith Lumley Centre, did some analyses of the longitudinal study of Australian children with her team. The team at AFES, led by Dr. Leisha Q, also did analyses from our Family Pathways suite of studies, which includes the longitudinal study of separated families and two cross-sectional studies of the experiences of separated families. Those ones are based on 6,000 samples each. We also wanted to interview 50 mothers to get greater and deeper insights into the experiences of women who had used services in relation to their domestic and family violence experiences. Before I talk about the findings in more depth, I just want to let you know about the terminology we're using. So we use the words domestic and family violence, where the research constructs and the measures are designed to measure that experience. We also use the term interparental conflict, which is the way that the measures in LSAC are described. But we want to acknowledge that there is some overlap between these constructs, and there is, at a particular point in the spectrum, a point where IPC might potentially merge into domestic and family violence. So I'm just acknowledging that complexity. I also want to acknowledge that there are limitations in survey data. They don't necessarily measure the severity of the harm that's caused by the experience. They don't provide good insight into the power dynamics involved. And we don't understand issues around the context, such as whether behaviour is committed in an aggressive or a defensive way. These surveys also potentially underrepresent parents who have experienced severe violence. And that's why we had the interviews with 50 women as a key element of the project. So I'm just going to briefly highlight some of the findings from the LSAC analyses around psychological distress and the experiences of mothers who report intimate partner conflict. I'll just highlight the findings around clinical levels of psychological distress. When we looked at mothers who reported no IPC, we found that 1 to 2% of the sample reported clinical levels of distress. This compares with 8 to 10% of mothers who had reported persistent IPC. The findings from the Family Pathways suite of studies analysis shows similar patterns. So we found that domestic and family violence negatively impacts relationships, parenting, finances, and children. Where parents reported physical hurt and/or emotional abuse, this was associated with negative interparental relationships and safety concerns, higher levels of parenting stress, increased financial hardship, especially for mothers, and poorer outcomes for children and young people. They had poorer general health and development, poorer socio-emotional development, and increased behavioural problems. Turning now to the impact of domestic and family violence on women and children that we found from our interviews with 50 women. The interview data demonstrate that there are mutually reinforcing, lasting impacts of domestic and family violence. The women reported that they had ongoing physical and psychological consequences that included post-traumatic stress disorder and high levels of stress and anxiety. They also reported ongoing psychological and sometimes physical consequences for their children. These included sleep problems, behaviour problems, and high levels of stress and anxiety. The mothers in the sample told us that they and their children continued to be exposed to domestic and family violence, where they continued to have contact with the perpetrator, sometimes as a result of ongoing parenting arrangements. In these circumstances, children continued to be exposed to poor parenting by the ex-partner, including abusive behaviours. One of the interesting findings from the interview data concerned fathers' abuse of service systems. 29 of the 50 women reported to us that they experienced systems abuse after separation. They reported that they had to engage with multiple systems and services, and that at times perpetrators exploited the inconsistencies between these systems and services. Perpetrators engaged in manipulative engagement or non-engagement with services and systems to exhaust the personal and financial resources of women, including their allocations of legal aid. This manipulative engagement included making counter-allegations in proceedings for personal protection orders and in parenting processes and in mediation. It included non-compliance with court orders and with child support obligations, and it was linked in some cases, such as Sadie's, to some mothers losing contact with children or becoming the non-resident carer on a permanent or temporary basis. So if we think about Sadie's story, we can see that it demonstrates the dramatic impact of financial violence on financial stability, despite the fact that Sadie had been the breadwinner for her family and maintained two jobs prior to separation. She ultimately became homeless and unemployed, despite trying to keep her foot in the workforce and support her family for as long as possible. This had a domino effect for her capacity to be the viable carer for her daughter. Despite the violence and abuse, her daughter remained with the father because he had a roof over his head. As a homeless person, or a person living in refuge, Sadie was unable to provide accommodation for her daughter. Sadie's story also demonstrates the fragmented responses to family violence. Child protection, family law, and homelessness systems were all involved in the situation, but there was no safe solution for Sadie and her daughter, no service provided for all of their needs. The impact of Sadie's ex-partner and his ongoing impact on Sadie and her daughter were not in the line of sight. No one focused on the fact that Sadie was continuing to be exposed to this behaviour, and her daughter continued to live with violence, abuse, and neglect. In conclusion, our research showed that there's insufficient attention paid to the impact on mothers and children of fathers' family violence. It showed that therapeutic support for mother-child relationships is very important, but inconsistent access to therapeutic support was reported by the women in our sample. There's an inconsistent focus on recovery in parent-child relationships, particularly mother-child relationships, in child protection and family law services. And there are barriers to recovery identified, with the domestic and family violence, child abuse and systems abuse perpetrated through post-separation parenting arrangements. I just want to acknowledge some organisations that greatly contributed to this research, including ANROS, which provided the funding, our advisory group of practitioners that made a big impact to our research and its validity and relevance to practitioners. The Attorney General's Department funded the Family Pathways suite of studies, and LSSF initially was co-funded by FACSIA. The Australian Government Department of Social Services, the Australian Institute of Family Studies, and the Australian Bureau of Statistics are the organisations responsible to LSAC. Thank you very much for your attention. I now am going to hand over to Emma and Jackie. Thank you.
Thanks, Ray. Our practice experience agrees with what you have been saying, that the system is fragmented. What Jackie and I are going to focus on for the next 30 minutes is how we as practitioners work within a fragmented system and what we do to bring cohesion to increase safety for mothers and children. First, we would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land of where we are delivering this webinar from on the Sunshine Coast, which is the Gubbi Gubbi Kabi Kabi people, and pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging. And we would also like to honour all the mothers and children we have worked with, who we have learnt so much from and who inspire us and motivate us to do this work. And another thing I think that we want to talk about too, in this time of, you know, COVID-19, we know everyone has this on their minds, and that the pandemic will increase the impact of domestic and family violence for adult and child survivors and victims. This is why having a cohesive approach focused on perpetrators' behaviours and tactics is pivotal to our work, as it helps us to identify how he, the perpetrator, can use the pandemic to entrap and control her further, and how their status of living with a pandemic, possibly contracting COVID-19, makes them more vulnerable to his abuse.
Thanks, Emma. So working with a fragmented system, we will refer to Sadie's story as this highlights, in particular, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander culture is invisible, and how we combat this in everyday practice as well. So what builds cohesive practice? What we have found is having a consistent approach when working with fathers who perpetrate violence against their families, focused on their behaviours and them as parents across services, and not blaming the mother for the harm he is causing. That is our experience in working with services such as child protection, probation and parole, counselling, police, DV services, family support and Indigenous services, and the court system. Creating one system that is focused on him as a parent and his parenting choice to use coercive control as a source of harm for his children, whether they're biological or stepchildren. This is a shift that we have found has made the difference.
Yes, and I think if we look at Sadie's story, the father's behaviours are invisible throughout Sadie's story. As Ray states, the impacts on Sadie and her daughter were not in line of sight, but also the father's role as a parent and his patterns of perpetrating. His behaviours and tactics are hidden. You know, they're hidden by him, and the current system supports them being invisible by being fragmented and not coordinated. And as a society, there's a gender double standard. We are not focused on him as a parent compared to mothers. It's this paradigm shift to change this that brings the women and children's safety sector together to collaborate and makes their work less fragmented.
Right. With dad's choices, whether good or bad, impact child and family functioning, and the absence of seeing him as a parent reinforces that men are not important. Aboriginal men, in particular, are ignored or vilified by our systems. Helping our men is important to Aboriginal community, and we want to value him as a parent equally to her. Sadie's story also highlights how First Nations people's culture is invisible. The system's abuse, which stems from racism or white privilege, hides culture for our people. That means it makes us invisible in systems, services, policy, and practice. I think that is because there is an underlying racist belief that domestic violence is part of our culture. When we view it as part of our culture, Indigenous fathers who are using coercive and controlling behaviours are not held accountable and not given the chance to be supported to change these behaviours. When his behaviours are visible, we can safety plan better. As we see in Sadie's story, little engagement with mum and no apparent engagement with dad made for poorer responses, services not being set up to be culturally safe. There was a lack of understanding that if Sadie's partner is non-Indigenous, how will he use racism as part of his patterns of abuse against her and the children, and how he has the privilege to use the system to abuse her further. So now we will cover briefly what guides our practice and then the four areas that builds cohesive approach. So, as discussed earlier, a culturally significant approach and a domestic and family violence informed practice together is needed when working with Indigenous families who experience family and domestic violence. Our main guide is the Safe and Together model, which is a strength-based, child-focused, and uses a perpetrator pattern-based approach. I like it because it's holistic in working with families and has been my guide when working with my people. This model gives language and a frame of reference to assist when working across services. Also using it on the ground, we have seen crucial difference in the reduction of unnecessary removals in child protection. And instead of rescuing children from mothers who have the capacity to care for their children, child protection is now focused on him as a parent and now intervening with the father to reduce the risk he poses to the children and create safety. I don't have time to talk more about this model. However, there's a link in the resources for the Safe and Together Institute website for you to investigate further. Over to you, Emma.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, another influencer, our practice on the ground, has been participating in several community of practices. And now we have had 4 community of practices in Queensland, which the Department of Child Safety, Youth and Women in Queensland have been involved in. Community of practices has had a tremendous influence on increasing our domestic and family violence informed practice across the agencies and strengthening our multi-agency work together with us in this community of practice, applying the Safe and Together model for our cases. So 2 of these community of practices were developed, researched and headed up by Professor Kathy Humphreys with David Mandel and Kyle Pinto from the Safe and Together Institute. And they provided key findings and guide in intervening with fathers as parents who use violence. The resources from Invisible Practice Research focus on key skills identified for working with fathers who use violence and control. And there is a link below to this resource on this website. The second research community of practice in Caboolture in Queensland was named STACY, which stands for Safe and Together Addressing Complexities. And this community of practice, for all those agencies involved, really advanced our knowledge further, looking at domestic and family violence and the intersections with complexities, with substance misuse, mental health issues. And they're developing a guide from STACY, from this research, which will no doubt be on the ANROS website that we can use for our practice on the ground. And the other influencing guide for us in our practice has been the Walking with Dads program, which is a real unique program that both Jackie and I have been involved with. So it's an initiative by the Queensland Department of Child Safety, Youth and Women, and it has been in operation since 2016. It's in 4 child safety service centres, which is Caboolture, Gympie, Caloundra and Mount Isa. And it's where a DV specialist works in the Child Safety Service Centre to embed the Safe and Together model and focus on a response to fathers who perpetrate domestic and family violence. So the Walking with Dads worker, just to give you an idea, contributes to the overall case management of the family, has a specific focus on perpetrator accountability and the need for intervention with the father. You know, as we know, historically, fathers have been invisible in child safety work, leading to that, you know, failure to protect model, which blames and holds mothers responsible for father's abuse against the family. So the Walking with Dads practice is built upon 2 strong foundations. So the first is that the safety of mothers and children is paramount. And the second is that the partnership with the mothers and sometimes children as well and young people, we partner with them too, is the foundation from which to plan family safety and effective intervention with fathers. So, and Walking with Dads is also focuses on supporting fathers in their behaviour change journey. So that's sort of a little overview of our influences that have guided our practice. So we'll just go on to that. Next slide.
Thanks, Emma. So we're up to the key areas of focus for cohesion and integration. So my mate Emma and I have been trying to think about key focus areas that make a difference, and we've come up with 4. Can we have a drum roll, please? and we'll address each of them.
Okay.
So Emma with the perpetrator base.
Okay, so the perpetrator pattern-based approach we see is a safe and together model term, and we see as essential a key area that you need in actually bringing cohesion to the services. So basically having this approach focuses on safety. So it focuses on the patterns of coercive control, and it's effective because it identifies the perpetrator's pattern as a source of harm instead of mum's choices or relationship status or living arrangements, which we have seen happen when we've been involved in those multi-agency working. So it's the domestic violence perpetrator and his pattern of behaviour as a source of harm, what we look at for risk, and not the adult survivor. So if she's going to leave, we'll then shift to instead what are his behaviours and tactics. So mapping his behaviours is an effective way to understand the risk he poses to her and the kids, and actually gives us that full risk assessment.
So the perpetrator pattern-based approach names the behaviours and does not attack the man's essence. And that's very important for Indigenous people, as we don't want, you know, our people, our women don't want our men to be oppressed further. And this has led to suicides or incarcerations, mistreatment by authorities. And this is based on our history occurring. So with my mum, she didn't want my dad incarcerated, and she wanted someone to support dad to stop and help him, but that never occurred. When we don't see the importance of men's behaviours, we're kind of out of alignment with adult and child survivors' experiences of reality. So Aboriginal people are more communal in our values. So Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander men have been marginalised and targeted. So having a framework around the importance of fathers' behaviours and choices to the family is culturally safe, because it reinforces the idea that helping men is important to the health of the community. So I want you to think about, you know, it helps us to identify domestic violence perpetrators, their roles in the family harm, as well as the positive input non-violent fathers are having. And it gives us a way to start equalizing out our expectations of men and women as parents. I'm not in any way trying to excuse his behaviors, but I can tell you that Aboriginal women want community to be able to address this. Mum loved my dad, and we loved our dad, and my mum did not want our family to be split up. Like most Aboriginal women, we do not want to leave, you know, our community or the father of our children, and we want services that can address their behaviours and give our men the opportunity to change. Again, the mother and children will guide our intervention, and we must respect Aboriginal women and their views. We must take their lead, as they will tell us what is the safest way to intervene. Again, like we had said, focusing on his behaviours takes the blame from mum, and it directs it back to the source of harm of the child and family functioning. This is important for child safety, as they often work from a failure to protect model, which actually blames mum for father's destructive behaviours and the harm to children. So I'm going over to key number two, which is about partnering, and partnering as a default position. And I must say, this is essential to our work. And if you are not doing it, you're probably doing unsafe work. If you are thinking about working across the system, and you're a service that doesn't engage with survivors, then I suggest you engage and connect with the service which is partnering with the survivor, just to create safer work. We listen closely to her experiences and map his patterns of behaviour in order to inform safety planning and interventions with the dad. When we partner well, we identify all the actions she has taken to keep her children safe and what has worked in the past, and we can see how we can enhance her safety plan. So like the slide says, the strength-based technique is where we are all in alliance and partners in safety with the survivor. If we partner well with her, what we find is that we find his pattern of coercive control and the details and the themes of the abuse. We find out what she is doing to keep the children and herself safe. We actually discover best ways that we can help keep her and the children safe and how we can actually intervene with him safely, because we need her lead on that. We also identify who are influencing family members and friends to help hold him accountable and responsible for safety, and we gain evidence of increased safety and parenting improvements that dad has made. So to sort of demonstrate this, I probably would like, Emma and I are going to do a role play. So I'm home alone, not like the little kid, but anyway, Emma is the worker and I'm the survivor, and Emma's come to see me at my home to talk about an incident.
Okay, so I'm first going to talk to you, Jackie, in a non-partnering way. Okay, so mm-hmm. I'm going to do that first. So here I go. Okay. So Jackie, I'm here to talk to you about a DV incident that you and your partner were involved in and how this is unsafe for your kids. I'm going to talk to you about how you both need to stop DV, because our role is to keep your kids safe. So what I'd like to see you do is not let dad back in the home. I'd like you to take a DV order out, or a protection order, to stop him, and so this doesn't happen again and he can't come in the home. And when I come back, I'd like to see that he's not here, because if he is here, I'll probably have to report you. So that's the non-partnering way. So how did you feel when I spoke to you in this non-partnering way?
Oh, Emma, I didn't feel good. I felt like it was my responsibility, and that Emma thought I was involved in the violence, and she lumped me in with dad. So she kind of mutualized the behaviors, and I was just as guilty as him. So as an Aboriginal woman, I was fearful for my kids being removed, and she actually separated my kids' safety from me, as she wasn't worried about my safety. And then she made me feel uneasy, and that she believes that the kids are safer without me. I also felt that, you know, she thinks she knows better than me, then, you know, asking me to get a DVO. I know that the DVA may not protect me or my children. So the other thing is that I'm under 5 foot and my partner's 6 foot. How am I going to stop him from coming in the home? I'm buggered. So, please, Emma, can we do the partnering way? Because I'm feeling a bit unsafe here.
Okay. So now I'm going to do it in a partnering way. Okay. So, Jackie, I'm here to talk to you about your partner's behaviours and his role as a dad, and how I'm really worried about your safety and your kids' safety. I know that you are doing a whole heap of things to keep your kids safe and well, and I'd really like to talk to you further about this, and also about, you know, how I can work with dad to assist him to be safer with you and the kids. I really want to take your lead on what's best for you and the kids, and how I can work with dad to help him be a safer dad. So how did you feel when I just used the partnering way to talk to you?
I felt much better, thanks, Em. I wasn't blamed for his behaviours, for starters. And I felt that you cared about me and my kids, and you actually saw me as a protector, and that you are looking to take my lead on how to work with him. So that really made me happy. You also included that he was accountable, and you said you wanted to support him to be a safer dad. So I felt that you're not trying to split the family up, and you didn't want to totalize him by his violence. And instead, you wanted to work with me and not forcing me to do things that were going to make me unsafe. So thank you.
Okay. Well, that's good. So look, that conversation leads us to holding dad accountable and responsible as a parent. So that takes us to the key area, number three. So we'll go on to that. Mm-hmm. So holding him accountable or responsible across the system, his behaviours and the impacts are no longer invisible when we document and communicate about it with the perpetrator, other services, and with survivors, like we were just doing then in the partnering. We are then actually seeing his behaviours and him using those behaviours as a parenting choice. So his responsibility is much more than not being violent. It's rethinking what his role is as a father, and having higher expectations how he will support the mother and be a safer dad. So naming his behaviours and impacts on the kids and the family functioning, family ensures that he is held accountable for his decision to use violence. And services asking him what he is doing for the safety, healing, nurturance, stability of his children will enable us to question his parenting and focus him on his parenting responsibilities and hold him to the same standards as we do for mums. So that's, I think, really important. Our experience is that dads are motivated by being better fathers. So this is the area we want to focus on across the system, and where we have had the most success in fathers reducing and ceasing violence as well. And so what we have found that when we've done that, and the system, so services such as probation, parole, neighbourhood centres, other services involved, when we're talking and using the language of accountability across the system, we actually have a much better impact on him and motivating him to cease and reduce behaviours. So I'm just going to go on to the next slide, just to give an example of a tool that we use. It's a Safe and Together tool, and it's known as the case plan grid, or we call it sometimes the accountability plan or risk management plan. And it demonstrates how we, on one document, can have his patterns of coercive controlling behaviours. We have the impacts on the kids and the family functioning that his behaviours have caused. And we also have on that plan what we want him to change, and then who can support this change and how we know it will be different. So it's a document. So if we go to the next slide, we'll see this plan, and we can see how this is a document that we can use across the system, across services. So we don't have time to go through all of the detail on that document, but I just want to draw you to a few things on that document. So if you look under, for instance, interventions, you can see the different services that in this case were involved with this father. So we had police who are monitoring him and breaching him if he doesn't abide by the order. We've got child safety involved. We've got probation and parole involved. We've got behaviour change involved. So it shows you, it's really clear about what services are involved and what they're going to do in regards to holding him accountable and responsible. And so I think that the other thing I wanted to focus on here, but most importantly, that is the last column focuses on the change we need to see, because this is not about him attending services, rather his commitment to demonstrate as a father that he's choosing behaviours that are safe for his kids and family. So you can see there that what we need to see is that immediate safety has increased for the kids, that he can acknowledge his destructive behaviours and the impacts on the children and their mother, that he's abiding by the DBO. So there's a list of things that we can put there that we know that there's change. But what's fantastic about this tool and how we've used it is that this is, again, designed and created with mothers and children and young people. So they actually, so in this case, this is a de-identified case. This is a mother who's actually said what his behaviours are, the impact on her and the kids, and what she wants to see change. So I think that's, again, where mothers and children and young people are leading the intervention with fathers. And, you know, we might have some more questions about this, and we can discuss that further at the end of our presentation. So this takes us to the last key area, number four, which is we've got to have multi-agency work and an integrated service response if we're going to do this well. And the system just can't do this effectively unless we're using a perpetrator pattern-based approach. So if we've got every service using a perpetrator pattern-based approach, it means that we're always communicating about his behaviours and the impacts these behaviours cause, rather than focusing on what the survivor can do. And that's really what we've seen as the current failings of integrated service responses on the ground, is that we end up focusing on mothers and what they're doing, when we really want to talk to across these services, we really want to talk about his behaviours, the patterns of his behaviours, and the impacts on the kids and family functioning. So I just go into that next one there. We want to focus always on how we can hold him accountable, responsible, and services, again, who I think Jackie, you spoke to this, but services who only work with perpetrators have an opportunity and need to proactively connect with services that are partnering with survivors for ongoing risk assessment, risk management, and effective safety planning. Rather, and checking in with her, rather than safety plans being done to survivors, instead survivors are there, you know, leading the way in that. That's really important. Okay, so over to you, Jackie.
So I just want to bring up that multi-agency work needs to include Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander organisations or identified staff. For Indigenous dads, it's important to have Indigenous services that's designing behaviour change programs, and not just anger management or parenting programs. They need to work with dads and speak to coercive control and behaviour change. Domestic and family violence is not men's business. It's everyone's business. And it's important to note, for non-Indigenous fathers, their responsibility is support their children's healing and connection to culture, as that's very important for our Aboriginal children's identity as an Aboriginal child. So the last slide, and we want to see the difference for Sadie and her children, you know, in a very cohesive system. So some of the good things is that we're focused on the perpetrator's behaviours as a source of harm, and avoids being deflected to failure to protect approach. It improves partnerships with the survivor and children, and it improves our safety planning, engagement, and or intervention with perpetrators no longer invisible. They can now, that can lead to increased safety. Support and recovery for survivors and children based on his impacts, and evidence for court so that magistrates can make informed decisions. Because in Sadie's case, she didn't have an affidavit, and no one thought about capturing what's going on for her and the children. Sadie would have felt, you know, believed, listened to, and safe to disclose information without fearing any repercussions on her and her children. And she would have felt some form of self-determination for having a say on what safety looks like for her and the children, and have family that she trusted and needed in her life, not who he sort of wanted to be present. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Jackie and Emma, and thank you to Ray. We're going to go to some questions now. Thank you to everyone who submitted a question. There's many of you on the line, so we'll try and get to as many questions as possible. I just want to check that Jackie, Ray, and Emma can hear me at the moment.
Yes.
Can you give a shout out? Yep, you can. Yeah, great.
I'm good,
yep.
Adam.
Brilliant.
I'm good.
Okay, so I've got the first question that we'll go to is probably, and I should just say Stephen Locke is going to join us for the Q&A session too. So thank you, Steve, for joining us. The first question that we have, this is probably best
addressed by Emma and Jackie or Steve. So what would be the most useful thing that a practitioner could do to help someone in Sadie's position?
So it's Emma here. I think that probably what we would say is what would be the most important thing is to do partnering with Sadie. So that was that key area two we discussed. If we're thinking about that safety is paramount for Sadie and her child, or, you know, for women and children, this is the first step in understanding the risk he poses to her and the children and what she's already doing in the context of his abuse and keeping her and the kids safe. So I would say that would be your starting point.
Yeah.
Did you want to add at all, Jackie or Steve?
Yeah, I wouldn't mind saying a couple of things. I just want to say, like, probably the partnering is the most important thing. So probably don't assume, especially with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, you know, families and women and stuff like that. Be careful on how you approach the situation, and language is very important. So to build that trust to start with is your key thing. From that trust and that rapport, you're going to start getting information that's going to be crucial to, you know, mapping behaviours. So don't assume anything. And I think you have to engage, like, as many people, Indigenous, like, organisations as you can, but, you know, make sure that everyone's DV informed. Don't put culture over safety.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jackie.
Jackie, Steve.
I just wanted to add, I couldn't agree more to what Emma and Jackie have said. The thing about the partnership is that in lots of ways it's, the Walking with Dads work we've done over the last 3 or 4 years, that the partnership becomes a foundation. You know, what one of the mistakes you can make is thinking that this way of working, the thing to do is to get out and engage the dads and engage the perpetrators. But I think what we've learned, and Safer Together has been so influential, is that the partnership with the mother, the victim, is a foundation from which you do that work with him. So I think it's a mistake to think that you can do the work with him without either you or someone in your professional network having built a strong partnership with a mother, because the two things are so dependent on each other.
Thank you. That's really good responses there. We have another question for Jackie, Emma and Steve. How can we hold the perpetrator accountable if we don't or cannot work with him?
I think that this is a big question that comes up all the time. You know, like the work that all three of us do, that this will be a common thing. It will be the sense of that either my agency doesn't work with dads, perpetrators, or it will be we try to, that they just won't have anything to do with us, or we can't find them, or they're evasive or abusive. And the answer here is really important. It's that actually accountability can be achieved. Emma and Jackie talked about it very well. Can be achieved through documentation. It can be achieved through much more diligently recording what he is doing and he isn't doing. And it can be achieved by making notes that say, I phoned him and he told me that it wasn't his problem, we should be speaking to the mother. Making a case note that says that, and then adding some comment to it that in your view, in your assessment, this means that he was taking no responsibility for the welfare of his children. Mm. And maybe feeding that back to him that that's the kind of case note you're making. And Emma and Jackie talked about perpetrator behavior mapping. That's another really important part of accountability. So if you can really diligently document what he's doing and how it's harming the family, that is accountability. You don't even need to see him.
Yeah. I think even how we talk to survivors about him, that you have to have a language of accountability in that, you know, that we're talking about, and that's certainly what we've had, you know, how we've tried to shift in child protection, is talking about him as the problem. We're involved because of his behaviours, and that role play that we did was really demonstrating that, that was accountability, even how we're talking to her about him and his behaviours.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you. I'm not sure if Ray had anything to add to that, or we might go to another question.
Oh, I'm happy to take more questions, Adam. I think Jackie, Emma and Steve have covered it admirably.
All righty. So we have another question which leads on from the last one. And I think it's just a question of kind of clarification. And the question is, how do you engage fathers in this work, and are they court ordered to participate?
I was just going to just check. Do they mean in this work in regards to walking with dads? I'm thinking, is that what we think that means? Or
well, perhaps just respond to, yeah, perhaps just in that program, but if even more broadly, if you can, consider the more broad.
Well, actually, walking with dads it's actually voluntary engagement. So it's not, it's not court ordered. It's not, probation, parole, community corrections. In regards to, when we work and walking with dads, we can certainly work with them to, that we're all on the same page. That's really why we like those risk management or accountability plans, that we're all working together. But I think that that sometimes, fathers are mandated to do things. Sometimes they're not mandated. But, we have found that we have a range of responses from fathers who use violence and abuse when they're mandated and when they're not as well. And of course, if we're working in child protection, we're motivating them around their kids. So, we want to work with them so they're safer and better connected fathers. So we have found that is a motivator for working with fathers that use violence and abuse.
That's right. I just wanted to add that when we are engaging the fathers, it's all about their role as a parent and their role as a father and what that means. So once you start going away into a way where it's about behaviour and how that's affecting their children, then you see a different attitude in regards to them wanting to work with you or not. So you're not going to save everyone, but you definitely get that shift when they see that, because most of the time these guys don't want to perpetrate, all right? These guys just don't know, and they don't have anyone to help them work through sort of things that are probably being second and third generation now of domestic and family violence. So language is very important in how you engage them and always pivot back to the children.
I would just add to what Jackie says, because I think it's so important that Jackie says that, we recognise them as a parent, and that thing about their motivation around their kids. One of the things we're saying is, well, as a parent, the way to be a good dad, a good parent, is to support the mothers of your children. So we're not allowing them to kind of just say, oh, I am nice to the kids, but she's my problem. We're kind of making it very clear that actually, if you care about your kids, you've got to support the mother of your kids. So we're not allowing them to kind of slip away on, I'm only doing this for the kids. We're making it very clear that as a co-parent, your respectful support for the children's mother is absolutely what it's about.
That's true.
Because sorry to hark on, but because through colonization they lost their role as parents and as a caregiver and stuff like that, so that all comes into play. And if we start showing that we support we want to support them as parents, you get a different attitude and stuff like that. Thank you
all, we really appreciate your responses to that question. So another question that's come through is, what if your work with the perpetrator might make things worse or dangerous for the mother and the kids? How would you respond in a practical way to that situation?
Well, this is going to bring us back to the partnering, because when we are intervening with fathers, mothers are a lead on that. And children too. I mean, what we've found in doing this work, we're asking children and young people too about how we're engaging with dads and what we can talk to him about and what we can safely say without any repercussions for mum and the kids. So that's why the partnering is the foundation of the work. And, you know, we would say that it's a real concentrated partnering. Everything that we do with him, before we meet with him, we talk with her. Afterwards, we check back in with her and the kids. So it's really based on that partnering. And of course, mum's the lead, and she'll tell you what's safe and what's not safe. And those grids that we put up there, that accountability plan, is a great way to do that. We've had mums that have put all the behaviours and impacts, and then they've highlighted with a highlighter what we can talk to him about. And then over time, they might say, yeah, now I want you to talk to him about this. And they highlight what we can talk to him about safely. So again, you know, it just brings us back to that partnering.
Thank you, Emma. Time for one more question. And in thinking about your response to this question, maybe just think in general ways, because the question relates to COVID-19 and the present situation. And I'm just conscious we don't want to give people specific advice about that. But the question is, due to the present situation, and we are all working via telephone with no face-to-face allowed, how can we best check that the mother and her children are safe and okay? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I can probably comment. You know, I mean, it's a rapidly evolving situation with COVID, obviously, and I think that we're at a hugely challenging point, because the question has raised this issue, you know, again, and it's come up again and again in our work in the last few weeks. Basically, COVID is a huge opportunity for some men, some perpetrators, to isolate and control mothers. And we know that those situations make mothers, victims, more vulnerable, and their children more vulnerable. I'll try and say one or two things, but I'd also strongly recommend that people go to the Safer Together website, where David Mandel is every day putting on new material about how best to manage in this situation. I mean, the question, rather than give you kind of, you know, perfect answers, the question really becomes, how can you maintain those kind of partnerships that Emma's and Jackie are describing in a situation where you can't see her face to face, and you're then trying to deal with a situation where phone calls or Skype links or any other form of communication may be monitored by her partner, the perpetrator. So I'm not going to attempt to give the definitive answers to those questions, but it just gives another big piece of thinking that needs to be done about how you build partnerships in the absence of one-on-one direct contact with mothers, victims. Jackie, did you want to add?
Yeah, look, I think that's a very difficult question there. And, you know, I'm just wanting to say that if you have been working with a mother in the past, you hopefully before COVID that had occurred, that there was that safety plan that you were doing with her. And should this happen, what would you do? So I'd probably be looking at every resource that you can get out there, especially David Mandel's and any other ones that you can get, just to see how to approach that, because every situation is different. And depending on your relationship.
I'd certainly say that, you know, if there's ever a time when multi-agency, cross-agency communication and planning is critical, it's now, because it really means that sometimes, of course, the domestic violence services are the very best people in understanding how we might be able to communicate with mothers safely. So it's always critical that we do a lot of cross-agency assessment, risk management, but it's probably more important than ever right now, because probably no one agency is going to have all the answers, you know, as if they ever did.
Well, thanks everyone for participating today. Once again, I'd like to acknowledge and thank Anne-Rose for collaborating with us to produce this webinar. For more information about the research projects discussed throughout the presentation, including domestic and family violence and parenting, mixed method insights into impact and support needs by Dr. Ray Kaspiev, and the research reports, Invisible Practices,